My pleasure to welcome every one of you to this session on Malaysia. So I like to promise you that this is going to be a very insightful and a very interesting session. First of all, I'd like to introduce myself. You know, my name is George Mack. I'm the Asia Area Director of Public Affairs, working for the Asia Headquarters Office of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Hong Kong. So it's my pleasure to be here to be with you today. And so I'm acting as the moderator, for this session. And I hope the translation equipment is working fine. And as you notice, we have translation for several languages that include the Laotian and the Mongolian and then English and Japanese and Vietnamese. So please let me know if any of those languages would not working. So please let me know. All right. And today we are very grateful to have two very distinguished speakers. For this session, we have a reference Dr. Herman Satris and also the Mr. Andrew Kuo. And the full biographies of the two of them is provided in the program booklet. So I won't take too much time to provide too much detail. But as a brief introduction, I want to say the reference Dr. Herman Satris is a well-known, well-respected religious leader in Malaysia, as he is actively involved in promoting Christian unity in Malaysia. He is the General Secretary of the Council of Churches in Malaysia. He is also the General Secretary of the Council of Churches of... he also served on numerous committees, including the Nationwide Consultative Council of Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, Taoism, and Taoism. And the other speaker, Mr. Andrew Kuo, is a lawyer by profession. And he is also the legal advisor to the Bishop of the Anglican Church of West Malaysia and also to the Archbishop of the Province of the Anglican Church in Southeast Asia. Andrew is also the co-chair of the Human Rights Committee of the Malaysian Bar Council, and he is the executive committee member for the Christian Federation of Malaysia, which represents 90% of the Christian community in Malaysia. So without further introduce, I would like to first turn the time to Andrew to the report on Malaysia, good structure, and also the challenges and issues that relate to human rights and religious freedom in Malaysia. And after that, I would like to turn the time to reference Satris. And after that, after their remarks, we will have time, for question and answer, and that will provide the means for conversations and exchange. So first, we'd like to turn the time to Andrew.
Thank you, George. Can everybody hear me? Wave if you can't. Okay, I see no waves, so I assume everybody can hear me. Thank you very much. Good morning. In my language, in Malay, selamat pagi to all of you. Selamat datang. Welcome. I'm glad that you are interested in Malaysia, and I hope that in the course of the next hour between Herman and myself, we will be able to share with you some of the things about our country and some of the challenges, both in the wider area of human rights, but also more specifically, religious liberty and human rights. Right, this is what my country looks like on the map. It's divided into two sections, separated by the South China Sea. So you have Peninsula Malaysia on the left, and the Borneo states of Sabah and Sarawak, the northern part of the island of Kalimantan on the right. So we are a federation comprising, as I said, Peninsula Malaysia, or West Malaysia as it's sometimes known, and Sabah and Sarawak, East Malaysia. We have 13 states and 3 federal territories. Peninsula Malaysia borders Thailand to the north and Singapore to the south. And of course, Sabah and Sarawak shares the island of Kalimantan with Indonesia and Brunei. The total landmass is about 330,000 square kilometers, and our capital is known as Kuala Lumpur. We were under colonial rule by the Portuguese from 1511 to 1641, the Dutch from 1641 to about the officially to about the mid 19th century. The British started coming to then Malaya in about 1786 till 1941, when the Japanese took over for about 4 years, and then we returned after the Second World War to British rule from 1945 till 1957. In 1957, Peninsular Malaysia gained independence from the British, and then later on, Malaysia was formed in 1963, and that was a coming together of Malaya, Sabah, Sarawak, and the then nation state of Singapore. And this, we all came together in 1963 to form Malaysia. And then Singapore separated from or became independent from, or depending on which history book you read, was chucked out from Malaysia in 1965. Our population is approximately 28 million, and ethnically divided to Malays, about 54-55%, Chinese, about 25%, indigenous peoples, about 11%, ethnic Indians, about 8%, and others, about 1.2%. We are a rich country of ethnic and cultural diversity, and therefore, the preservation of national unity is of prime importance, and sometimes where the government's concern of overriding importance. Major religions in Malaysia are Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, Taoism, and Sikhism. And then there are nominal amounts of animistic faiths as well. Major languages spoken are Malay, or Bahasa Malaysia, to give it its official title, which is the official language. And then, of course, you have English, you have various Chinese dialects, including Mandarin as an overall language, and then you have various dialects from the Indian subcontinent, Tamil, Telugu, Malayalam, and others. So we are a very multilingual country, and if you, like me, only speak very well two languages, you're actually in a minority. Because most people will speak three or possibly four or much more than that. And of course, Herman speaks German as well, so that makes it even better. Some of our challenges in terms of politics, our current prime minister, it's the sixth prime minister since independence. His name is Najib Razak. That's his full name there. He's the son of our second prime minister, not quite Bush 41, 43, but somewhere along those lines. And he's been prime minister since 2009. The ruling Barisan Nasional in Malay, or National Front, is a coalition government comprising mainly the three largest race-based political parties and about 11 other ethnic or sometimes non-ethnic-based political parties. And that's one of the challenges in Malaysia, is the fact that politics, to a great extent, is still very much race-based. So you have the three main parties, the United Malays National Organization for the Malays, the Malaysian Chinese Association for the Chinese, and the Malaysian Indian Congress for the ethnic Indians. The government, after many, many years in power, lost its two-thirds parliamentary majority in 2008. The two-thirds parliamentary majority is significant because it allows the government then to change the constitution. Without a two-thirds majority, it requires the cooperation of the opposition. And in the recent election in May 2013, notwithstanding its main goal of recovering that two-thirds majority, it failed to do so. Although it managed to reverse the opposition political party's victories in five of the states in 2008, and they won back two of those states. Our federal constitution is the supreme law of Malaysia, and it establishes Malaysia as a federation with a division of power between the federal government and state government. However, we have a rather weak form of states' rights, and a lot of the power is centralized in the federal government. We have a constitutional monarchy, given the fact that we had traditional royal households that predated the coming of the British into Malaysia. We have 9 royal households, and we have the world's only rotating monarchy. In other words, representatives from each of the 9 royal households take turns to be the supreme head of Malaysia for a term of 5 years. In the constitution, it is provided that Islam is the religion of the federation, but it is also provided that other religions may be practiced in peace and harmony. So we also are a Westminster-type parliamentary government that provides for separation of powers. So we have the judiciary, the executive, and the legislature. But like in a Westminster-style system, the legislature, to a certain extent, is dominated by the executive. So that's just in case you didn't know what separation of powers was. Article 76(1)(a) of the Federal Constitution provides for the power of Parliament to make laws for the purpose of implementing any treaty, agreement, or convention, including human rights treaties. We're now turning a little bit to the international element of our laws. However, Malaysia practices what is known in legal philosophy as a dualist legal system, which means that in order to give effect to international treaties of any sort, and also international human rights treaties, you actually have to have domestic legislation first to be passed. It's not the case as in some other countries where the moment the government signs an international treaty, it is binding and gives rights to its citizens. So international obligations only become law once there is domestic implementing legislation. For example, Malaysia has, in terms of international human rights treaties, we've only ratified or signed or acceded to 3 of the international conventions, the first being the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the second, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, and thirdly, the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. All these conventions have implementing domestic legislation. All were acceded to or ratified with reservations, and those reservations are reflected in the domestic legislation. So the domestic legislation does not replicate each and every provision of those international conventions, which can be rather frustrating at times. So not all aspects of the treaties have been incorporated into domestic law. No, none of the others. 3. Those are the 3. In terms of liberty of the person, it's guaranteed under Article 5 of the Federal Constitution. 2 preventive detention laws, which had the origins way back from the 1960s, ceased to be enforced in 2012. One was the very famous or infamous Internal Security Act 1960, which was abolished in 2012. Just to give you some ideas of what the ISA allowed, it allowed for preventive detention or detention without trial. And it didn't allow much by way of a judicial review of detention orders, and people could be put away for 2 years at a time, renewable indefinitely. And so we had people who had been in detention for maybe 8 or 9 years continually. It has since been replaced by this new legislation of Security Offences Special Measures Act 2012, but which has a very wide definition of what constitutes a security offence. And it permits detention of up to 24 hours, renewable to 28 days, and then denial of access to legal counsel for up to 48 hours. This is the law. The practice tends to be somewhat different. We also had another notorious legislation called the Emergency Public Order and Prevention of Crime Ordinance from 1969, which was an emergency piece of legislation that was promulgated as a result of an emergency situation which the government declared due to some racial riots in Malaysia in May of 1969. This has also since been withdrawn, ceased to be in force since June 2012. Even as we sit here in very sunny Provo, Utah, inciting the rise, sorry, I missed out the word, that the rise in violent crime. The Prevention of Crime Amendment and Extension Act has since been passed in Parliament, which allows for a reintroduction of detention without trial. So we had a brief holiday of about 1.5 years, and now we are back to detention without trial. And the government has said that this legislation is necessary to deal with the rise in organized crime. But again, because of the way the legislation is drafted, it is very wide, and it could well be abused or misused to cover political or other dissent of the government. And so we campaigned very hard against it, but the government took it as a matter of principle to bring this back, and it is now, it will be law shortly. We also have the death penalty still in Malaysia, and it's used in mandatory form in some cases. In other words, there is no judicial discretion. So once a finding of guilt has been made, death sentence is compulsory. It's generally used for murder and for drugs-related offences. And there's no official change to the current position, although there has been some discussion about removing, in respect to drugs-related offences, the mandatory nature of that death penalty. We also have freedom of assembly, which is guaranteed under Article 10 of our federal constitution, but then it is also limited to a certain extent. It was limited previously by Section 27 of the Police Act, which required police permits before you could have a public assembly. That provision was repealed in April 2012. What we have in place now is this wonderfully innocent-sounding Peaceful Assembly Act of 2012, which, however, has limitations and prohibitions. Assemblies in motion, what we would normally call street protests, are strictly prohibited on pain of a fine. You have to basically give 10 days advance notice for any peaceful assembly that you want to have. The police may set terms and conditions for which you would have to comply. Failure to do so will also lead to a fine. Just some pictures of how peaceful assemblies in Malaysia look like. Yes, and the government's response to what they say are breaches of the peace during peaceful demonstrations. If you've never had smelt tear gas or water cannon, please come to Malaysia. We'll share it with you. In terms of freedom of expression, this is also guaranteed under Article 10 of the Federal Constitution, but there are several measures available to silence dissent, including on matters relating to Islam. We still have a pre-colonial Sedition Act, and if you understand, I mean, the Americans would understand the Sedition Act because it was widely used in colonial times to silence dissent against the government, silent formulations of dissent against the government. So that those elements and those principles are still very much present in Malaysia. So it's often a question of where to draw the line. You can criticize the police to a certain extent, but the police have also said that if you criticize this too much, you undermine law and order, you undermine the administration of justice, and therefore your comments could be seditious. And therefore, we have to be rather careful when we do public discourse and discussion on various issues. There has been an announcement that the Sedition Act might be amended or rather repealed to be replaced by a National Harmony Act. And who could argue with an act like the National Harmony Act? It's almost like motherhood and apple pie. But so far, we've not had much details about it. But we are told that the sedition elements, to a certain extent, will be maintained. So not much new there. We also have other ways of limiting freedom of expression. We have a Printing Presses and Publications Act, which requires a government license for any publication. It was recently amended to remove a requirement for annual licensing. The government had used annual licensing as a Damoclean sword over the heads of newspapers and publications. If you don't toe the line, we don't renew your license. That has since been removed, but you still do need an overall license to print and to publish. We also have the Official Secrets Act. We don't have a Freedom of Information Act. And we also have penalties under our penal code for hate speech, hate crime, and things of that nature. We've also had recent amendments to our penal code and criminal procedure code, which basically allow for this new offence called undermining parliamentary democracy, which counsels violent disobedience to the law. And this was put in place, I think, very much to try and nip in the bud any attempt to replicate Tahrir Square in Egypt and the Arab Spring uprising. And we've also have amendments recently to the Evidence Act, and basically what it now says is that any material that is sent from a computer which is linked to you is prima facie sent by you unless you can prove otherwise. So the presumption is against you that you are the author or sender of any information on the internet, and if that information then also counsels violent disobedience to the law, then you could get done for offences against a parliamentary democracy. Coming more closely to what we are dealing with here in Malaysia, in terms of freedom of belief, it is guaranteed also under Article 11 of the Federal Constitution. But I think you now, by now you all realize that what's given with the right hand is taken away with the left, and there's always in the balance of a right, there are also restrictions. So there are limitations to the rights of freedom of belief. And in this case, I've already referred to, in passing yesterday in my presentation, to this issue of the word, the use of the word Allah by non-Muslims, especially Christians, who speak the national language, Bahasa Malaysia. The High Court in 2009 said that the government ban was unconstitutional, but the issue is still unresolved. The hearing before the Court of Appeal just concluded last month, and we've just received news in the last 2 days that the decision of the Court of Appeal will be handed down on the 14th of October. So it's a coming home present for me when I get back. So in this particular case, the Herald, which is a Catholic weekly newspaper, was denied an annual publication permit because it had used the word Allah. And legal action was taken against the Malaysian government by saying that this was Christian material and it was not... This was an exercise of freedom of religion and belief. We've also had other instances where Christian material in Malay language containing the word Allah has been stopped at the border and not being permitted to be brought into Malaysia. One of the other issues in terms of freedoms of belief is the conflict between the jurisdiction of civil courts and a parallel Sharia court for Muslims. And this is where we're going to come to just a very quick rundown of some cases. The real-life dilemma is the fact that disputes have arisen where rights are contested in situations where with conversion-related issues. So you usually have a situation where there is a couple, husband and wife. It's usually the husband who converts to Islam, partly because he's fallen in love with a Muslim woman and wants to marry her. And then what happens then to his... subsisting marriage to his non-Muslim wife and the rights of the children, rights to custody to the children, rights to inheritance of the property after that conversion has taken place. In the past, we've also had questions of renunciation of Islam. We have a very celebrated case of a woman called Lina Joy, who was brought up as a Muslim, converted to Christianity, and then wanted her identity card, which all Malaysians have to carry, to be amended to reflect the fact that she was no longer a Muslim. The National Registration Department said you can, so long as you go to the Sharia court to get a declaration that you have left the religion of Islam. She refused to do so on the grounds that that might lead her to being arrested and detained for rehabilitation purposes, to try and persuade her not to leave the religion of Islam. These are laws which are provided for in Malaysia. A person attempting to leave the religion of Islam may be apprehended, liberty denied for 120 days at first instance to undergo some form of rehabilitation. And if that hasn't succeeded, they can extend it for a further 60 days. And after 180 days, it is still not sure whether the Sharia court will actually give the person a certificate or a declaration that he or she can leave Islam. And this is precisely the position of Revathi. Revathi was a Muslim woman. Her parents had converted to Islam, and she had she was therefore nominally a Muslim, but she had been raised by her Hindu grandmother. And she grew up and she married a Hindu man. And then one fine day, I'm not quite sure 100% of the details, one fine day it came to the attention of the authorities that she was actually still a Muslim. And so she was detained for the maximum 180 days. And after those 180 days, she still decided that she wanted to leave Islam. And so what the court did was to release her into the custody of her parents. This is a full-grown, fully-aged woman, but she was released into the custody of her parents, and she was not allowed to leave the religion of Islam. And that's the position that holds until today. So you have that issue of conversion of spouses to Islam. So we have in Malaysia, three celebrated cases also of three Indian women, Subhashini, Shamala, and Indira Gandhi, all of whose husbands converted to Islam. Some of them managed to convert some of all of the children into Islam, whether in reality or in absentia, without the spouse's consent. And in Malaysia, what happens is that we have a very interesting law where in a case where a husband converts, there is almost a statutory divorce that is triggered. But that divorce is only triggered in 3 months. And so what has happened naughtily is that some of these husbands and fathers rush during that 3 months of a sort of a statutory no-action period to go to the Sharia court to get a custody order for the children and then try to whisk the children away from the mother. And this is one of the issues that's still outstanding in Malaysia in terms of how do you reconcile two conflicting legal systems which run parallel to each other. Okay, so again, just going back to freedom of religion, belief, some relevant factors. We are a multi-ethnic, multi-religious community, so we have a diversity of religions. As I said, you've got these problems of Lina Joy, Revathi, Shamala, Subhashini, and Indira Gandhi. So you have different laws for Muslims in some areas. Personal law is governed by, if you're a Muslim, Islamic law, and you go to the Sharia courts for any issues arising out of personal Muslim law. And then there are offences against Islam, which are particular to the Muslim community, gambling, alcohol, not fasting during the month of Ramadan, and khalwat, or what is known as close proximity, where two people who are not married are found in close proximity to each other, giving rise to a presumption of some illegitimate activity going on between them. And there's a debate at the moment. Is Malaysia secular or an Islamic country? As I said, one of the provisions in our constitution, which I referred to earlier, is that Islam is the religion of the Federation. Does that statement make Malaysia an Islamic country? Or is that statement mainly to suggest that Malaysia is a secular country with a nominal religion of Islam to cover public ceremony? That is still a debate that is raging until today. I won't go into too much of the details of these cases. I've tried to explain it to you already. I think we'll just try and go to... And in some of these cases, the litigants have, understandably, they have actually fled Malaysia. They've taken the children, for example. Subhashini, I believe, is now living in Australia with her children because she can get no justice in Malaysia, and she's afraid of what might happen to her children. So that's pretty bad. Lina Joy also, I think, is no longer in Malaysia because she's had to flee. So we attempt to introduce international provisions from international covenants, but in all of the international covenants, we've taken exceptions where the provisions of international covenants come up against the understanding of Islam in Malaysia. So we have a more or less a blanket reservation for all positions, whether in CEDAW, CRC, when it comes to rights under Islam. So as I said, then those laws are implemented in domestic legislation with those reservations in place. So recourse to international treaties and obligations does not provide for any relief within the Malaysian legal system. Civil society efforts in terms of freedom of religion, we've tried to raise awareness, open up debate to protect the rights of non-converting spouse and the children. And we have in place what we call the Article 11 Coalition of Non-Governmental Organizations. We champion protection of constitutional rights, including freedom of belief. And we are critical of the Islamization process that has been going on for quite some time. Most people will point it to a consequence of the Iranian Revolution in 1979, which, you know, for the first time, a Western-supported power was brought down by Asian and sort of Muslim countries, and that wave has sort of moved over the years to envelop much of Muslim Asia and Southeast Asia. And then we also have women's groups that are taking up the causes of the women involved in those issues. Just a little conclusion here. We need to uphold, I mean, this is the call for us, is to uphold the fundamental rights of freedom of belief and equality for all, regardless of what faith one chooses to profess or not to profess. Contestations do not evolve around the issue of religion per se. And Islam is not a bad religion, we're not saying that, but rather what we are living under is the consequence of politicization of the religion of Islam, misinterpretation of religion, misuse of religious principles. And so religion, politics, state personal laws have become very interlocked. And other current issues in Malaysia, just to round it up, we have many issues regarding law enforcement personnel, the integrity of the police, and who seem to operate in an environment of impunity. We have a lack of accountability. We have many deaths in police custody. We have also many cases of police shootings and police brutality, which have not been resolved. Although we had an election, and we have regular elections in Malaysia, there are increasing questions about the integrity of our election commission, which supervises our electoral process, the cleanliness or the integrity of our electoral roll, issues of phantom voters, issues of gerrymandering and constituency delineation that favours the government of today, and the weakness of our accountability system in terms of judicial challenges to election results by way of election petitions. And then we have continuing issues affecting the rights of indigenous peoples, both in terms of land and also freedom of religion. We have issues affecting migrants and refugees, the rights of migrants or guest workers who often have to work in sometimes slave-like conditions. We have the issue of refugees, where Malaysia, consistent with its stand on other international documents, has yet to sign or accede to the International Convention on the Rights of Refugees. And we have issues of trafficking in persons and also freedom of association. So in a nutshell, those are some of the sort of a snapshot overview of some of the issues currently facing Malaysia. And what I'll do now is I'll let Herman say a few words as well. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Andrew, for providing all that information. And I'm deeply grateful that it has given you a bird's eye view. And I will just try to add a few comments from another perspective so that we can get into a discussion of matters at hand with regard to Malaysia. But since I have a lawyer as a colleague in this presentation, if you have any questions, I'll direct my lawyer to answer them afterwards. Now, there is a given, I think, from the sharing this morning, there's a given reality that makes up Malaysia. and that is, it is diverse. And that is nothing strange in Asia. In any part of Asia you go to, nation states are diverse, made up of ethnicities and made up of religious communities. So the visual you will get when you go to Malaysia is that you will see the presence of different ethnic groups. And since Malaysia also has considerable demographic presence of Chinese and Indians, who are major civilizations in Asian history, thus this tagline, Malaysia truly Asia. So you get presence of Southeast Asia, you have Indian presence, you have Chinese presence. And that's how the government tries to promote Malaysia. But the point and the reality on the ground is, it is diverse. If you are born in that country, you get accustomed to this diversity. You would have neighbors who may be Chinese, Indian, Buddhist, Hindu, Sikhs, Muslims. You go to school, that's the reality. And so that naturally speaks about a mix, overlapping of social interaction. That constitute what Malaysia is all about. So the task of any government in a diverse population is to manage this diversity. And so Malaysia is just one example of many other Asian countries of how governments seek to manage this diversity. And I think Andrew has shared that there are some forces that work upon the political environment in our country that has resulted in a certain outcome. And that outcome is that politics has always been race-based. From the time of our inception as a nation. But actually, I've been around to many Asian countries, and it is no different. Race is, ethnicity is very important, because that's where the politicians draw their electoral base. So they need to be attractive to the people they seek, the support they need. So in Malaysia, till this day, you have parties at the ethnic base, and the dominant is the Malay Party, which also is synonymous to be an Islamic-based party. So the Malay and Islam are synonymous terms in the country. Islam, as you have seen from the statistics, is the majority, but it's not the absolute majority. It makes up to about 60%. And under the Islamic community, you would have the Malays, and the Malays are also in themselves diverse. And then you have the ethnic, the indigenous ethnic communities who may have embraced Islam. Christians, since this is a Christian institution, we make up about 9% of the population. One of the other realities, we have race-based, religious-based politics, but we also have one government ruling the country since the time of our independence. And this government is a coalition of race-based parties, and the coalition has only grown in time to include other ethnic communities from the eastern states of Sabah and Sarawak. It has also become obvious to us through the sharing, and probably from what you read, and even from visual, if you go to modern-day Malaysia, is the growing presence of Islam. Islam has taken on national profile in discourse. They would also speak of Malaysia being a Muslim majority nation. The monarchs are all leaders of Islam, the head of Islam in their various states. There is a lot of Islamic symbols that come into play in the execution of the work of the parliament. The king comes, there is a prayer, and so on and so forth, somewhat like when Queen Elizabeth goes to parliament in England. But this is the reality, and this is what is going. But what has happened is in the course of the years, in the last 30, 40 years, three decades onwards, there has been a growing effort on the part of government to increase the profile of Islam. And those are for political reasons, on one hand. On the other hand, also the whole resurgence, if you could use that word, of Islam in the world. Yeah, there is a certain assertion of Islamic rights, Islamic presence, Islamic civilization, Islamic sphere in geopolitics, and that has affected Malaysia too. So as a result of this growing profile of Islam, there's also certain words that have come into vogue, and one of that, one of these words or terminology has affected the psyche of the non-Muslims, and that is that word Islamic State. Islamic State. So there are quite frequently this term used, although it's not in the constitution of our country, but that Malaysia, being a Muslim majority nation, prides itself as being a nation that is modern and yet based on Islamic principles in governing the nation. So the Islamic State has become almost an idiom of defending and protecting Islamic interests in the country. And that goes through at all levels. The monarchy takes on a special position. The Islamic leaders are the Malay leaders who are Muslim. The increased presence and voice of the Ulama Council, the state religious bodies, Islamic religious bodies have taken on a greater role and prominence, and so on and so forth. So, question would be, on one hand, democracy, and Andrew has spoken about the threats to civic-based democracy, but there's also the whole question about peaceful coexistence in a nation that is diverse, a government that is called to manage diversity. How do we move forward? And surely, one of the obvious things that have come to fore is that it cannot go on the way it is now. That although we cannot eliminate the reality of ethnic communities participating in the political life of a nation, and religions being closely associated to certain ethnic communities, the wider vision would be to move away from ethno-religious sense of nationalism to, that's the question mark, to what? And this is therefore a search for a proper term. Most of the non-Muslim groups would speak about a secular state, that the constitution provides for Malaysia to be secular, but Muslims react very strongly to that term, because that would be associated to the Western project of government, which in Muslim perception is adverse to Islamic interests. And so Muslims suffer in many Western countries that are so-called secular, and secular equals less emphasis to the belief in God. Yeah, anti-religion. That may be in the minds of many of the other minority communities, but another term that is being used in discourse would be maybe democratic, participatory, and progressive nation. These words, democratic, that means the rights that are already in the constitution should be granted to all citizens. Participatory, that as the nation progresses, we are a modern nation. We don't want an elitist government. We want a government where people are participating and different interest groups are bringing their concerns into national life. And progressive, that in a modern nation, you cannot have laws that are backward. You need to keep up with international standards of democracy. So in terms of interfaith dialogue, and that's where I would locate myself in the work that we are doing, is to find the environment or the platform or perhaps even the word safe space to engage in such dialogue. The safe space. Because what is happening now is a dialogue of contention. So you have the Muslims on one side and you have all the other religious communities together in a consultative, interfaith consultative council, who are constantly monitoring the process of Islamization and reacting to that. And those on the other side who are the Muslims are trying to understand the reaction of the non-Islamic communities and to find ways in which they could so articulate their Islamic interests in such a way that it'll be acceptable to the non-Muslims. So that is the nature of the dialogue it stands now. So safe space, a conducive environment would be where people not afraid to share their deepest desires and aspirations as a person of faith and same time as a citizen of the country, and to find common ground. Most of this finding of common ground is happening on the civil society, and usually it's on the basis of the struggle for democracy and the responsible participation of citizens in the democratic process. So as it stands now, it's not conducive, it's not helpful, because what is developing is an us against them attitude, and the use of the constitution to point to the faults of the other. And so the constitution is being interpreted in a whole lot of ways, and the difficulty with that is that in our constitution we have some provisions that complicate matters. With the fact that there's a phrase in Article 3, we said Islam is the religion of the Federation. All right, so a non-Muslim would interpret it in a certain way, but the Muslims would say, it's there. And that is guaranteed to us, and it, and this is what it should mean as a Muslim. And so it becomes difficult. The hope is that, of course, that there would be less of the politicizing of race, of Malay dominance, and Islam in the country. That is the hope. Unless that is overcome, I think we cannot get rid of ethnic interests, we cannot get rid of religious interests, but surely, unless there's an expanding horizon of greater issues, and so probably it points to also a reconception of the national ethos. And although there are many words that is bandied around by the various prime ministers, the current one is One Malaysia, but it just does not. It's good for the outside, and the prime minister just some weeks ago in the UN gave a great speech of moderation, which we who are from the minority religious communities think that's not a true statement of the position he takes in the country. So it's this dominance of Islam and how less politicizing of Islam may help in managing this diversity. Thank you.
All right. Well, I would like to thank you know, Andrew and also the Reverend Satris in providing us a very good overview with regard to the legal structure and how the human rights and religious freedom is governed in Malaysia. So I'm sure many of you may have the questions that you would like to raise with the speaker. We only have a few minutes left, and the time was almost up. So let's see if we can take two or three questions. And so I'd like to open up, you know, to the floor. So we'd like to handle the question. Okay, from the back.
Reporting here on the election.
Yeah, please speak to the mic. Yeah.
Reporting this year's election results for Malaysia, we understand that the opposition party actually won a majority of the popular vote, but because of the way the voting districts are gerrymandered, the ruling party stayed in power. Is there a realistic opportunity for the opposition party to ever gain control of the government?
We take a few questions. Or?
Let it address the question. One more one.
No,
okay. I think. All right. So let's take these two. Okay. So we have three questions. So after that, then we let the speaker to respond. Let's wait for the mic.
Two simple questions. The first is in the Council of Interreligious Harmony. Is this, I want you to say whether it is a governmental or a civil society organization, and whether Muslim organizations are represented, they would be if there is an interreligious thing in your country. And having visited Malaysia quite a bit, but many years back, the Malays were pretty clearly privileged in access to education and other public services. Is this privileging to the benefit, presumably, of Malay students, for instance, still operative, or is it has it changed? Is there more non-discrimination in access to universities and so on? Thank you.
Thank you. Let's take the last question.
Thank you for your excellent presentations. I was interested in some additional backdrop besides the political that you described. I'm interested in knowing more about the economic backdrop, whether there is wealth unevenly distributed among ethnic or cultural or religious groups, and population growth. and whether that has a factor in some of these questions you've raised.
You go ahead, start this.
It's a tossing of, okay, who's going to answer which? Maybe I'll address firstly the question on elections. Is there a realistic or reasonable opportunity for the opposition to win? I would say not within the present structure, simply because the electoral map is drawn in such a way that there is an entrenched bias in favour of the government. We have a situation where we have parliamentary seats, where in one particular constituency you may have maybe 30,000 electors in what is supposedly a rural constituency, and then we have an urban constituency with 130,000 voters. And so we have no sense of an equality of the value of each vote. We are trying to work to achieve that, but the government has a conflicting agenda. And we're actually moving backwards. In our original constitution, we allowed for a rural-urban divergence of up to 50%, recognizing that in 1957, communications was not good, road networks were not so good, and there will be challenges to reaching out to a more rural community. 56 years on from that, we have removed that 50% divergence provision. We've now inserted a more qualitative set of criteria to determine variance. And as a result of modernity, progress, and that qualitative criteria, the difference is now, instead of 50%, 300% and sometimes close to 400%. So we're moving in the wrong direction if you want to talk about trying to achieve a more fair and balanced system of elections. So that's why I say, under the present system, it would be quite a struggle for the opposition, even though they win a plurality of the popular vote, to actually take political power by way of winning a majority of the parliamentary seats that are on offer. If I can go to Tori's question about Malays, the privileging is still there. Some would argue that the government tries to find new ways to privilege the Bumiputra, what they call the prince of the soil, which is not just the Malays, according to them, but also the indigenous communities in Sabah and Sarawak. So Prime Minister Najib, in his first term, talked a lot about trying to achieve a more progressive, a more liberal, a more equal society. But I think partly as a result of challenge to his own personal political survival and also that of his party, what we can see already in the short months since the start of his second term in office after the election, he has almost reversing all his initial ideas, and he's gone back to status quo ante and basically gone back to privileging the Malay and the Bumiputra community. And in terms of the economic backdrop, again, I think it's linked a little bit to that. I mean, it's not just the educational benefits, it's also the economic benefits. Again, there was some attempt to try and say that we will go towards a system of more meritocratic distribution of jobs and of education prospects, and also when it came to the market economy, to things that are more sustainable. But again, because of the political pressure, Prime Minister Najib has reversed himself on that. So it's a fine line that he walks, because on the one hand, I think he's under some pressure from also from, say, the United States to open up Malaysia to a more internationalized system of trade. And Malaysia, the United States, and 10 other countries in the Asia-Pacific region are parties to this thing known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is currently under negotiation. And President Obama was supposed to come to Malaysia today or tomorrow to help out to move that process on. But since he's not coming, I think Prime Minister Najib is also going to backtrack a little bit on that as well. So the inequality is not just maintained or perpetuated. I think, again, after a brief spring of some sort for the last 1.5 years, we've gone back to an autumn of repression and inequality.
Yeah, with regard to the interfaith, I think there are two levels. Civil initiative, and that's what we have currently, which is the Malaysian Consultative Council for Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, Sikhism, and Taoism. And Islam is not there. There have, of course, been discussions within this Consultative Council. But from my experience of my involvement in there, they don't want the Muslims because of the Islamization process that's going on in the country. So this would be a vehicle to hold that in check as a counterpart to Islam. And if you should have Islamic groups, it may not be recognized by the government, and so it defeats the purpose. So which groups are recognized? Well, those, and that's the second level, Islam is state-sponsored. Yeah, it's recognized by the government, and over these 30 years, there's a whole bureaucracy of Islamic institutions, universities, and so on and so forth, tightly controlled by the government, benefiting from state funds. And these groups, because they feel they are part of government structure, feel they are part of government. And so Najib, realizing that he had lost the two-thirds majority, the party that Najib comes from, realizing they lost the two-thirds majority in 2008 elections, realized that he needs to be proactive on this interfaith basis. And so he has called into being a state-negotiated interfaith. Problem was, we couldn't use the word council because the Muslims rejected that and said, we are not equals. Yeah, Islam is the religion of the federation. Islam is state religion, and you are the minorities. So let's have a working committee for harmony. So that's the current terminology for this body. So we have that going on, but it is plagued with a lot of political pressures and intrusions that makes it ineffective.
Well, thank you. I think this is really a very helpful and informative session. Thanks once again for the two speakers for helping us to gain a better perspective and understanding of the situation that pertains to Malaysia. So I would like everyone to join me to give another round of applause to the two speakers. I'd like to thank you for your participation, and I'm sorry that we don't have much time. You know, I'm sure many of you will have more questions to raise with the speaker, but I will encourage you to come to the speakers, you know, another time and have a dialogue. And before we leave, Andrew has something, kind of give, we'd like to present to the Law Center of BYU. So we'd like to invite Andrew and Dr. Bob Smith would like to represent this BYU to receive this gift.
Just to explain what I'm giving to the center, it's four publications which deal with religious freedom in Malaysia, and also perhaps understanding a little better about the constitutional structure of Malaysia. And so there is a very new book that came out earlier this year on the monarchy and the constitution in Malaysia, written by a well-known local professor. And there is another report, and you can get this online. It's by a human rights organization that annually reports on civil and political rights in Malaysia. It's called the Suaram Malaysia Human Rights Report, and it's been going on for several years now, and I've had the privilege of contributing chapters to this over the last 6 years. So, it's in English, yes. And there's a chapter specifically on freedom of religion as well. And then some publications, Herman talked about the council, the Malaysian Consultative Council. This is something they came up with a few years ago about how unity is being threatened by infringements of religious freedom. And then one of our other sister organizations in Malaysia, the National Evangelical Christian Fellowship, has come up with a book on 50 years of religious liberty after 50 years of independence. So these are resource material for your center
and
for interest in Malaysia.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that very much.
Thank you.